telephone interview with Barbara Thomas Judge, Lady Judge, November 13th, 2005, by Kenneth Durr.
I'd like to start with a little bit of discussion about your background, your education.
Right. So I'm a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
I graduated from University of Pennsylvania and did history. And I went to NYU. I was a lawyer there. I'm a law student, graduated in 1969. Cum laude, I did very well, a lot of A's. And was on the law review. And won a lot of American Jurisprudence Prizes. It's all in my CV, I think we sent it to you.
Yeah. Where did the interest in law come from? Do you know?
Oh, absolutely. I wanted to be an actress when I was young. And my father was had lost all his money, and my mother wasn't having any starving actresses. And she said, if you want to act, you can act in front of a jury. But, of course, I never, ever saw a jury in my entire life. And I became a mergers and acquisitions deals lawyer.
No interest in trial law?
No, never. I have represented some big companies, and I did mostly transactions.
Mm-hmm. Why the interest in corporate law?
It was an accident, actually. I wanted to be a tax lawyer because I did very well in tax in law school, really extremely well. And it really was an accident. I was determined to go to Paul Weiss, which was the first law firm I went to, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Morton, and Garrison, and I was going to go to tax, into tax.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I arrived the first day, they said, oh, well, we've decided to put you in corporate law. I was actually quite cross. They said, well, if you still want to do it in a couple of years, we'll switch you into tax. And actually, what I figured out after I was there a short period of time was that they'd had another woman at the same time graduated who absolutely wanted to do tax, and I must have been equivocal about it in my interviews. So, of course, I went into the corporate law department, and I never left it.
What did you find about that was appealing?
I like practicing corporate law because in a good corporate deal, everybody wins. The buyer and the seller are happy. It's not really the same kind of adversarial process that litigation is.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a way people come to a happy conclusion when they both feel like they're winners.
That's the end result. How about some of the work? It would seem like there's a lot of sort of putting one's nose to the grindstone and working.
Oh, well, I'm a very hard worker. I'm an extremely hard worker. My whole career is about working hard and learning new things.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, it is a very intensively busy working, but it's there's a lot of adrenaline about doing it beyond you. It's very nice to have clients relying on you. You feel empowered as a young person, relied upon. And I had some clients who were very, very nice and complimentary and helpful, and I always felt like I was making a contribution.
Corporate law must have been pretty much a male province at this point. What was it like for you to break into that?
It was definitely a male province. But all of law was a male province, and all of law school was a male province. It's years ago the way women are treated. It was, well, there were a few of us. You know, it was the very beginning. There were a few. I worked very hard, and as I said, some very supportive clients. And I was a very tough lawyer. I always felt like I never wanted my clients to be disadvantaged by having a woman lawyer.
Mm.
So I was very tough. Not aggressive, but tough and firm, and made sure that I represented them to the best of my ability.
You moved on to Kay Scholer, I guess?
Kay Scholer, yeah.
Scholer.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about your experiences there. I guess you spent most of your time there.
I worked very hard. I worked for a very good man named Fred Fishman, mostly. He was a very senior partner, and he had a big practice in representing insurance companies, mostly in private placement debt financing. And I worked for him most of the time I was at Tishola. And indeed, if I'd stayed there, I would have inherited his practice. He had a big practice with the American Equitable Life Insurance and New York Life Insurance Company. And the thing about him is he was a perfectionist. He was very brilliant, and he was a perfectionist. And it was taxing, but he used to say working really late and hard builds a character. And I think it did.
Mm.
I thing about Fred is that he was very loyal. And I think I knew instinctively that if I killed myself for him over all those many years, that he would support me becoming a partner, which at the time was there weren't very many women partners at all.
Right.
Big New York law firms. And that's what happened.
Hmm.
He was definitely a mentor and a supporter and a friend.
You did indeed become partner there at Cajal.
I did.
Any notable cases, things that really shaped your outlook or your career that you did while you were there?
You know, there weren't really any notable cases. I did some big deals. I represented the Han, the Trisek, the big Canadian land development company, which bought the Han shopping center, which is a big deal. And it's still called Trisek Han, I think, today. And I did a number of other Canadian deals, which weren't actually for Fred, in the pipelining business. But mostly I did these big private placements. But, of course, there is one defining proposition, which was that I learned to be very precise.
Mm.
And that was what he was, very precise and very, very detailed. You know, he was a detailed person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now becoming quite a perfectionist.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You also worked with the New York City Bar at this point?
I did. Now, that was the one thing. Fred didn't believe in extracurricular activities.
Oh.
He believed you should work every night. But he did think it was good to do something in the Bar Association. And so he sort of supported my interest to do that. And I joined the Corporate Law Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I did become its first woman chairman on the Corporation Law Committee, which was a powerful committee in the New York City Bar Association. And frankly, that's about the only thing of note that I did as a lawyer, other than work hard every single day and every single night and every single weekend. It was a time when you really had to be better if you were a woman.
Right.
And I certainly was trying to be a partner.
Well, I guess the big question is, how did you come to the attention of the Carter administration?
Yeah, that's a very good story. Really nice story. When I became a partner, which was 1978, I think I became a partner as of January 1, 1970, I think. May have been 79. Frankly, I can't remember, but you can remember.
Yeah, it was 78.
Okay. At some point, my husband and I decided to go to China. It was just the beginning when Americans could go to China, and it was very difficult to get in there. And you had to get on lists to get on these group trips that Pan Am was running. And so we managed to be chosen to go on some businessman's trip, which was sort of senior business people. It was very expensive in those days, those trips. And the story is that we were also going to buy a co-op at that time because we were both partners and we had no children and had a little money. So we were going to buy a really beautiful co-op in One Sutton Place South, which was very cheap at the time because New York City had just been through the crisis, but it still had a big maintenance. And at some point, my husband said to me, Barbara, we can't afford both. We can't go to China and to Asia for this summer and buy this apartment. And so in one of my many wrong decisions, real estate decisions, I said, right, China will change. It's just the end of the Cultural Revolution. I mean, we didn't know it was the end of the Cultural Revolution, but it was. But
yeah.
It was China will no doubt change as it was opening up. And we can always buy an apartment. But we didn't buy the apartment, which last changed hands at about 30 times the price we could have bought it. One of the most beautiful apartments in all of Manhattan. But we did go to China. Now, why is that notable? Because on this group tour, there was a lady who was older of age, about my mother, and quite crotchety, I have to say, you know. But she was on her own and difficult. And I'm sort of a leader type, and I was intent on going to all the restaurants that the Chinese government didn't want us to go to because everything was very regimented. And I had read in a guidebook that they had somewhere in the French Quarter of Shanghai, there was lemon meringue pie. Now, I am what the Brits describe as a foodie. I have a great passion for food. And I was intent to find this lemon meringue pie. And I took a group, including this lady, looking for this woman wearing pie, which indeed we ultimately found in the French Quarter. It's amazing to see little Chinese people eating lemon meringue pie with chopsticks. But my husband kept saying to me, why are you including her all the time? Why are you taking care of her? She's so difficult. And I said, listen, she could be my mother. Oh, because she could be me. You know, she's alone. And women have to look after other women. And we have to look after her. So we did. And when we came back from this trip, she did what any nice woman would do. She invited me to lunch. And it turned out that she was the senior woman broker in Wall Street. Her name was Paula Hughes. She's a very nice lady. She's dead now. And then I went to lunch with Paula, and I said, you know, I could just become a partner, but the truth is, I really don't want to do it for the rest of my life. If I stay there, I will end up doing the same thing now, 20 years from now that I'm doing now, and I'll sit and look at the 59th Street Bridge from one viewpoint or another, and I want to try to find something to do. And she did what we would all do, which is said, send me your resume. So I did. And as the story goes, when the White House decided to put a woman on the SEC at that point, they did it, presidential personnel, like a headhunter. You know, we want a woman who's a partner in a big firm that does securities.
Right.
And they did a little search, or a big search, actually. And who did they call? They called Paula Hughes, because she was a known woman in Wall Street. And Paula Hughes said, oh, I know a woman. I have her resume right on my desk.
Hmm.
And that was me. And then they called the Bar Association, which you would do. And they said, oh, we have one woman. She's the chairman of the Corporation Law Committee. And so it was check, double check. And that's how I got the call.
You must have been aware of, you were the second woman to go onto the SEC.
Right.
And when you're making this decision, you must have been aware of Roberta Carmel's experience.
I did.
Was that in any way a cautionary, or did it encourage you to make the switch?
No. I mean, no and yes. The answer is I didn't know really what had happened to Roberta on the commission, to be fair.
Yeah.
I knew she'd gone there. And I remember, because I remember when she was appointed, I read it in the paper.
Uh-huh.
A year or two before me. And I remember thinking, what a lucky girl, that would be a great job.
Hmm.
And her credentials weren't all that different from mine.
Right.
If I'd known what happened, it wouldn't have made any difference anyway.
Yeah.
Because I was so thrilled with the idea of having it was a great way to change my career. You know, first of all, I was a securities lawyer, so the SEC is a god. It's a fantastically wonderful opportunity, and I was very honored. And second of all, it was definitely, I knew I would be a different person. I'd have my own persona, whatever that was.
How was the confirmation process?
Impossible. Do you know the story?
Excuse me?
Do you know the story?
I don't.
It was very difficult because it was the very end of the Carter administration. And basically the Reaganites, the Republicans, didn't want to confirm any more Carter nominees.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people at the SEC told me, basically, I really should forget it. That I wasn't going to get confirmed. And I probably would have forgotten it, but I was so thrilled with the idea, I just thought I can't give this up without crying, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about who did I know was a Republican, and there was one on the Corporation Law Committee. And I said to him, you know, I'd really like to get this job. I wasn't looking for it, but they have to have a Democrat anyway. They might as well have me.
Right.
And I had all these millions of A's, you know, I'd done so well in school. And so he said, listen, Barbara, forget it. No way. I said, don't you have anybody you could introduce me to, just one person? And he introduced me to Howard Baker's legal assistant. I don't remember his name. And I went and saw him, and I told him my story. I hadn't been looking for the job, but actually I thought I could do it, and I was a conservative Democrat. I thought you had to make the cake before you split it up.
Mm.
He said, oh, Barbara, you'd be perfect, but actually, you're not going to be more Carter nominees. Anyway, I said to him, I'd made a list of the Republicans on the banking committee. I think he'd introduce me to one of these people. And so he said, sure. And so I went around and I saw every single Republican on the banking committee and explained to them that I was conservative and I was not political and I would do a good job and I was very academic. And at the end, they basically agreed that they would do, you know, that they wouldn't be prejudiced against me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really wonderful.
So you kind of had to put yourself into the SEC, I guess.
I had to work very hard to get confirmed.
You came in, and Harold Williams was still the chair, right?
Right.
What was his leadership like? What was his agenda at that point?
It's interesting. I thought you would ask me that. I don't really remember. He wasn't there very long.
Right.
And I didn't have much to do with him. And I don't really, I mean, he was a very nice man. But frankly, I don't really remember what his agenda was, if I ever knew it.
Mm-hmm.
It was mostly getting, I came in so late in the administration. He was almost gone by the time I arrived.
Right. Well, what did you find when you came in? What made an impression on you in those first weeks or months?
Oh, what made an impression on me?
Mm-hmm.
That everybody was very confident and competent. And that the staff really thought they ran it. What else made an impression on me? That there was very smart people, very committed. Doing a job that was important.
At this point in the SEC's history, the Enforcement Division and Stanley Sporkin were still looming pretty large.
Yes. Stanley was still there, and I got on with him.
Mm-hmm.
I made an effort, because by then I did know what happened with Roberta.
Mm-hmm.
And I made an effort to get along with him. That's not to say I voted always with him, but we had a perfectly pleasant personal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely pleasant.
Well, what did it take to get along with him? I mean, what was it like working with him?
I didn't really work with him, actually. I mean, they would bring cases to the commission.
Right.
But you didn't really work with Stanley.
Yeah.
At least I don't remember working with Stanley.
Okay.
I remember working with people who worked for him.
Such as?
Well, who was there? Ralph Ferraro was there. My legal assistant, I think, had come out of enforcement. His name is Art Dilbert, that first one.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other people there. Frankly, I don't remember. The people soon afterwards, I got another legal assistant who was absolutely fantastic, whose name was Richard Starr.
Okay.
And Richard Starr was wonderful, and we got along really well. And he did, you know, I worked very hard. I had two really great ones. The other one was Steve Bohm. They both are still my friends today.
Huh.
Still my good friends. Richard is one of my best friends. Actually, Richard and Steve are among my best friends.
Huh. What kind of work did they do for you?
Well, I had my own agenda, you know.
Well, tell me about that agenda.
My agenda wasn't really theirs. It wasn't really the SEC's particularly.
I'll
tell you this story. I'm going to write it in my book, though, soon.
Okay.
I went out to California to give a speech. Actually, before that speech, I think, I can't remember the details of it, but I went to California to give a speech at some point. And on the way back, I was on the plane with a man who was the head of the Pacific Star Exchange. And he said to me, Barbara, how many commissioners who aren't chairman can you name? And I said, Al Sumner and Frank Wheat. I said, well, are those the only two? I said, because one had the summer report and one had the wheat report. And he said, that's right, and if you just do your job competently, you will, nobody will remember you either.
Hmm.
And then he went to sleep. And when he woke up in the morning, because remember those overnight planes, I said to him, I'm going to devote myself to internationalization, British markets. And he said, Barbara, you don't know anything about that. And this is a domestic law for domestic corporations. And I said, yeah, but I'm interested. You have to have looked at my background to see how academic I am.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got to the SEC. It must have been Harold, I guess, was still there. And I went and saw Harold and said I'd like to be involved in internationalization of securities markets. And he said, no, not really, Barbara. this is a domestic law for domestic. You don't really want to do that. And I must have looked very crestfallen. And he said, but you don't really have to listen to me. You know, you're an independent commissioner. You report to the president. You can do what you want. And I'm not sure if that's Harold or Jack Schad. It may have been Schad. I don't remember the dates of this all.
Mm-hmm.
May well have been Schad, actually.
Okay.
To be fair. And, yeah, because I came and the election was so soon thereafter. Remember, I only arrived in the summer and November the election was. So this must have been Schad. Anyway, I went back to my office and I did what one should never do. It was a grand gesture. And the George Washington Law Review had been hassling me to write a law review article because I'm so academic. And I'd been putting them off. I went back to my office and I called up this man who kept hassling me. I said, okay, I'll write an article on whether it's in America's interest to open the capital market slightly to let foreigners come and raise capital in our markets. And then I got off the phone and my legal assistant said, Barbara, you don't know anything about that. I said, that's true, but in 6 weeks I will. And then I thought about to learn it. And I did all these amazing things. I called Goldman Sachs and I asked the operator, this is Commissioner Thomas. Does anybody know anything about foreign securities, international securities? Don't you know, 5 minutes later I get this call back and it's from John Whitehead and it's like God calling me, you know?
Yeah.
Dear Commissioner Thomas, what can we do for you? I said, oh, well, I'm writing this article about international social securities markets. Do you know anything about it? And of course he said, we'll send you 4 people tomorrow. I said, no, I'm a lawyer. I'll come talk to you. Anyway, I called all the banks, all the investment banks. And I remember, they all were incredibly helpful. I didn't understand how powerful SEC commissioners were, so I didn't really understand that all I had to do was ask them and they would help.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to Stretch Gardner. It was a lot of the names in Wall Street that helped me. And I wrote a very long, and very boring, but very authoritative article on that subject. It had more footnotes than anything in the world. And that's when I got interested in it, because it was one of the first people who were writing those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote lots of other articles on internationalization of the securities markets. You know that because you asked me questions about it.
Right.
And I wrote an article once a long time ago that said, someday in America, maybe it was a speech, I'm never sure if it was an article speech, but it said someday, and it was called Thoughts While Shaving. It said, someday in America, men would turn on the radio and listen to what happened in the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And then what was happening in the London Stock Exchange. And then they'd go to work and look at their stocks. And I got hate mail. Dear Commissioner Thomas, stick to your knitting. Nobody cares about foreign securities. This is America. We have enough security. Put people in jail. That's what you're meant to do. But that wasn't my real agenda. My own personal agenda was to try to make an impact in what I believed to be something that would happen, which was that the markets would open and that we would be buying stocks in foreign markets and that we had to do it as a hedge against our own economy and that investments by big institutional investors that include foreign stocks. But it was very early and people didn't really care. Nobody was interested except me. So I kept writing these articles. Then I wrote articles that said we need international accounting standards. And Paul Volcker once said to me, Barbara, you really are naive. Nobody will ever come up to the high standards of Americans in accounting.
Paul Volcker told you that?
Yeah. I know how. I mentioned it to him recently. He doesn't remember, but he didn't deny it.
I suppose things looked a lot different back then.
You know, it's a long time ago. So, I mean, I came to England, funnily enough. I just gave a speech about this to talk to them about the F-Series, which I was very involved in, and telling them we were going to have to set out the remuneration for the 6 highest paid directors. They thought I'd lost my mind. How could I possibly want to do something so ungentlemanly as that, you know?
You're going to have to do what?
Do something so outrageous as to ask the directors to put forth their own remuneration package.
Oh, sure.
So, I just kept on it. I mean, if you look at what I wrote, it's all about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I was interested in. And then we were doing this F-series of rules, and that was going to, I was talking about accounting standards, and the SEC was going to make the foreigners put lines of business reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the Japanese were very powerful then, and they all
right.
wanted a list in London. I mean, in New York. And so I went to Japan to talk about the rules and negotiate opening the Tokyo Stock Exchange to foreign members because Salomon wanted to get a seat on the stock exchange at that point. Actually, they wanted to open a branch office, was what it really was. And actually, nobody was really interested except me. And so I went, and we did make a deal, actually. We let them office get a little on the rules, and they changed the legal rules to let foreigners buy seats. Of course, somebody pointed out to me when I got back that seats cost $5 to $6 million U.S. And by the way, there were only 83, and no one wants to sell. Now, actually, what happened to me was I said in some kind of article that I wrote, well, that may be true, but it may be form over substance, but in Japan, form counts. And so I will predict that in 3 years, a foreigner will buy a seat on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And actually, 2 years later, a seat came up. Merrill's was going to buy it. But at the last minute, the Japanese establishment came and bought it away. Yamaichi bought it instead. And there was such a hue and cry. Good thing I didn't write my article. It was already in draft. There was such a hue and cry in the international markets that they created seats, and three went to the Americans and three went to the Brits. And that's how Kidder got its seat, and Salomon's and Merrill's, and then the Brits over here got it. And there was some nice people in... A number of Wall Street people helped me in this effort. I'm not remembering the guy's name because all the firms are all... I wanted to say it's Kidder Peabody, but I'm not sure. Who are interested in foreign securities.
I understand that you went on, or at least one of the accounts is that you went on something of a goodwill mission in 1981 to visit other international securities markets. Is this the Japanese trip that you're telling me about?
That might be. I had an idea, which was to set up a council of securities administrators, like the Cook Committee in banking. Because I'd met Peter Cook, who was at the Bank of England, and he said to me, you should get together a committee, like we have a personal committee to work on international issues. And I tried. I went to Japan, that was one trip. I went to England, and another way that what happened was the Dutch were going to New York celebrate 300 years of sister city with New York City.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted me to make a speech. I said, I will, but I want to talk to the organizer of this convention or whatever it was, mission. And I met a man named Baron von Ittersen, who was the head of the Dutch Stock Exchange, Amsterdam Stock Exchange.
Uh-huh.
And I said to him, listen, I have this idea just to set up a committee, personal committee of international regulators. I talked to the French, too. I'd met a guy named Jean-Luc Lapine, who was at the Cub. He thought it was a good idea, too. Everybody thought it was a good idea. The guy at the Stock Exchange thought it was a good idea in London, but nobody wanted to come to America. They didn't want the heavy hand of American regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to Van Edison, who's a lovely man, I've got all these guys lined up, and I'll do all the work. You just host it, because nobody wants to come to America. So he did. We had a big meeting, a first meeting of the International Council. I don't remember what it was called, but it was an International Committee of Securities Regulators. And it was me, and it was the Englishman. It was a Frenchman, I told you. His name was Luc Lapine. It was a Canadian we had. And some place out in Australia. We met at least once in Amsterdam. I always wondered. May have met a second time, but I'm not sure. But I certainly was trying hard to get the commission into the modern world. But it wasn't the modern world. They were there. I mean, they were in the right place. The world was... my idea was a long time ahead of its time, if you think about the fact that we're still doing IFRS right now.
Right.
I'm still regulating. You know, I'm deputy chairman of the Financial Reporting Council here, which is...
But in the U.S., you do hear the foreign financial markets on the radio in the morning.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I mean, I'm always amazed when I go there now, which I don't do very often, and I listen and I see what's going on. I think, my God, you know, when I was talking about it, people thought I was just nuts.
the discussions you were having with the regulators in other countries was, and I was taken by your phrase, the heavy hand of American regulation. Was this mostly having to do with accounting standards?
No, that was my issue, because I had a good relationship with the accounting division, and they, I thought that it was important. You know, I still think international accounting, we're going to call them world-class companies, and there was going to be accounting standards for these particular companies so that you could read across from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, that was what I was talking about, but I was also talking about common registration requirements. You know, if you registered at a high level in England, you could use the document in America, etc.
Right.
And this is my ideas, you know. It was all about my... The whole thing was just an idea, I thought, that you ought to be able to cut down the regulatory burden by doing one registration document that any sophisticated capital market would accept.
Right. But was the bar higher for registration in the U.S.?
Yeah, and that was what everybody said. Mm-hmm. You know, why should we come up to your standards? We'll never get our population to do it.
Mm-hmm. And what was the, from the U.S. side, what was the idea?
Nobody really cared. You can't imagine how much nobody cared what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was being written in the SEC, the F-series, which I was involved in, which was a way for foreign registrants to register.
Right.
But it was very fledgling at the time. And it wasn't much different, the F-series, than the regular S1 requirements.
Okay. How popular was, did companies avail themselves of the F-series?
Well, they did. Ultimately, when the foreign companies wanted to come to America, they had to.
Mm-hmm.
Which was meant that the Japanese came first. The Japanese are very powerful. I'm always interested in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was about exchanging information and trying to have more common new rules, you know. If people are going to re-regulate, they should regulate in a common fashion.
Did you have any involvement since you, the foreign foreign markets and foreign government seems to be your bailiwick, did you have involvement in the discussions with the Swiss?
You know, really, I had a little bit. I knew the Swiss, but that wasn't my issue. The enforcement, I think enforcement sort of took it over.
Yeah.
And John Shad basically said to me, Fetter's going to do this. Is his name Fetter?
Right, John Fetter.
He and Fetter's were great pals. And they're going to do this. And we don't really want you to do it. You do your own international stuff. Well, you know, your more common registration requirements, accounting standards. I really didn't. The Swiss were surprised because I knew them.
Mm.
And I had made some speeches there. But they... I didn't. My fingertips are not on those. Those times. Chad didn't want me to do it.
Yeah. Did you hear from your acquaintances there how things went with Fetters?
No. I mean, the problem was at that point, Fetters. I don't know what's ever happened to him. But Chad, they really were quite keeping it quite to themselves. This effort, and I. You know, I sort of had made a deal with them. I wouldn't bother. I'd do my own. I wasn't. Now, once they wanted to do it, they should do it.
Yeah. Well, can we talk a little bit about John Shad and what was on his mind? He, of course, had the big push on insider trading. And I'm wondering if you got the sense on the commission that this really was something he was driving or something that he just sort of fell into.
I think he fell into it. But I have to say, he and Fetters were big pals, you know? And they did everything together. And I wasn't really in their inner circle. I had my absolute own agenda at that point. I was interested in international. I was interested in opening the capital markets. I was interested in making an impact on something that I thought was important.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing insider trading, and I was happy to vote, you know, but I never got a sense of John Shad that he had an agenda, particularly that was his own.
Mm.
I thought he was there, and he and Fetters sort of hooked up things.
Mm-hmm.
That was my opinion.
Yeah, well, you would have had time to shape it because you did sit in the meetings.
I did.
And watched.
We were very involved in it, but I just couldn't have said it was his. I couldn't have said it was his agenda, or that not the commission's agenda.
Right. Okay. Well,
I thought it was the commission's agenda, and I wouldn't have known who was the person who thought it up.
Right.
That's what I mean. I mean, I just don't know whose idea it was. They were obviously doing it. It was certainly what we were thinking about.
Right.
I wrote a number of things about insider trading myself. I said we should have treble damages for insider trading. I remember writing an article about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the commission's agenda, and everybody was involved in it. But I just didn't know what was his
right.
Issue.
Well, that's an answer to the question, actually. So one of the issues, of course, is that the 70s is known as the period when really the staff is running the SEC.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if you got a sense that was changing at this point, or if the staff was still running the SEC.
I think it was still running it. I mean, that's my opinion. I didn't really perceive John Shadd as being anything more than friends with the staff and therefore doing what they were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But I may be wrong.
Yeah.
But that was certainly how I feel. That what we were doing was about the staff. They got him interested in something, and then he'd do it.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that I mentioned in what I wrote to you is it's a bit of a landmark, and your involvement may have been tangential, but that was the Citicorp decision. That certainly made the headlines. Do you remember the discussions surrounding that issue?
I saw that there, but I don't remember it.
Okay. The commission decided not to act on an enforcement case. It resulted in a great deal of publicity, and you actually recused yourself.
Yeah, because I knew all the Citibank guys.
Yeah. Okay. But my question was simply this put the SEC in the headlines for a while, and I was wondering if there was discussion of that on the commission, or if you.
No, it was. I did recuse myself, and I'm now remembering that it was because I knew nobody. But it wasn't what I was. It was a big deal, but it wasn't what I was thinking about.
Right.
Just remember, what I was trying to do was to do something positive.
Right. Right.
To do something that would last beyond my term on the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
That was my idea, quietly, to make a contribution,
okay.
Not just react.
Right.
That was always my philosophy.
Can we talk about some of, you spoke a bit about making connections, traveling, establishing this group. What are some of the concrete things that you pushed for on the commission?
Well, I think there was the other thing which you did notice was that I was very interested in Rule 415,
mm-hmm.
and I was wrong. That was very important to me. I don't know why. I did get to know the regionals. Somehow or other, while I was on the commission, I got to understand the regional securities firms. And I believed it was important to have regional securities firms and to have access to capital, not just through the big companies.
Right.
And I can't tell you why I thought that, but I believed it. And when Rule 415 was proposed, I believed, I should have reread my decision, my dissent for this, but I believed that in a down market, Rule 415 would be difficult, I'm just not being articulate about this because I don't remember it exactly what the theory was, but if there was a down market, the shelf registrations that would be there, the big firms would have an opportunity to push the little firms out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I was against it. Now, I could get out my dissent and read it. That was the basic problem. I thought that it was that you'd write registration statements. There would be diligence at the time, but it wouldn't be up-to-date due diligence,
right.
And that things would have changed because obviously the market was down, and therefore the economic environment was down, and that things have come to market that shouldn't have come to market.
Would it be more difficult to do syndications given the quick turnaround?
Yes, and that the little firms would be exactly, you've obviously read it more recently than I have.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. They'd be aced out of the business. They wouldn't get into the syndicates.
Yeah.
And that there would, the market would be dominated by big firms because the time would be so quick to turn around things.
But, of course, shelf registration sort of went through a trial for perhaps a year or so before the decision to make it permanent, before you wrote your dissent.
Right, but it was still not really a down market. And I was
okay.
I only worried about the down market. It seemed to be okay before.
Okay.
And so my decision said, this won't work in the down market.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about giving the regionals an opportunity to operate within the time frame of the syndication process.
Hmm.
Now, the reason I was wrong was because, who knows what would happen today, but from the day I wrote my dissent, there was not a down market for 20 years. Literally. My dissent came out on the day that the Mexicans defaulted on their debt. This much I do remember.
Uh-huh.
And for some reason, that started the market, stock market's going up, and the market's never stopped. And so it never happened. The circumstances that were predicated, my dissent was predicated on never happened.
Huh.
The thing that really was very gratifying to me, it was a very big piece of work, and from my point of view, I'd worked really hard on it. And I met somebody years later who said, we read your dissent in the Columbia Law School.
Hmm.
as part of our securities course. But I thought that was important to make that point.
Was this a pretty unusual thing? A 37
No, people never made the dissent. I never heard of anybody doing it before.
How was that received?
Well, I don't think John Schott didn't like it. I mean, he wasn't happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But commissioners are independent, as you know.
Right.
The thing about it is, and as I say, I only got your questions yesterday, so I didn't really think about it, but I should have reread it. But from my point of view, I wanted it to be very authoritative, and I worked very hard on it.
Mm-hmm.
And from a piece of writing, it's probably the best piece of writing I've ever seen.
Hmm.
Just a long time.
Did you hope that at one point perhaps it would be pulled out and become the basis for...
I did. I hoped that... What I hoped was that... Well, first of all, I hoped it would sway people. I mean, I sent it around. But obviously everybody was doing what they were thinking about it. But I hoped that at some point some judge would pick it up.
Hmm.
If there was a big securities case. You know, I mean, what had to happen was the market had to turn around.
Mm-hmm.
But it never did. But it was all part of the fact that I was trying to, first of all, nobody took that position. And I have always tried to do it, to be an expert in a small subject.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could make a difference. And that was my opinion, and I thought, by that time I had learned that the way to make a difference was to write something. And so I thought, I don't think this is going to work. I think the little firms will get aced out of the syndication process.
Mm-hmm.
I think the due diligence will be stale. And somebody should say something.
Mm-hmm. Now, was this fairly late in your...
It was just at the end.
Yeah. Okay. So shelf registration was being given a trial earlier on, during 82, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Was it your sense that that trial would probably not work out?
I thought the commission was hell-bent to do it.
Mm.
And that it was a bad idea.
Okay. What were some of the other areas in which you were trying to make a difference on the commission?
Well, the other thing I was interested in was cash flow accounting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember saying that it's what's in the cookie jar that counts. And I believed, I got in my head the idea that that cash flow accounting was very important, and that really it was about cash. Like, I never really could understand about depreciation, all sorts of non-cash items. And so I wrote a number of articles about that. The other thing I was worried about was extraterritoriality. Because I went around to all these governments to try to set up my securities regulators group. I realized that around the world people were thinking we had this huge long-arm jurisdiction, and that it was that's where the rules, the heavy hand of Americans came in. And since I wanted to foster good relations among the world securities regulators, I thought that all this extraterritoriality was one of the major obstacles to it. So I wrote some articles about it.
Can you define that a little bit for me, the extraterritoriality idea?
Well, I think it's still there. If you have a securities problem in America, you have a stockholder in foreign land, they have the right to the security. They have the right to the protections of the securities laws.
Okay. So what was your what did you
well
want?
I think I what I wanted the Americans was to define what they where the jurisdiction stops.
Okay.
And sort of give people. I think it's probably right actually that if you're a company and you come and use our capital markets, then you have to manage to put yourself within the American rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is. And take advantage of the market, you have to have the obligations of the rules.
Okay. And you were looking to have that better defined.
Exactly. So people knew where they stood.
And I guess the way things get done, of course, are to come up with these ideas and give them float them, and then perhaps put some rules together.
Mm.
On any of these issues that you were pushing, were you able to do any of that?
Well, what was happening? There were a couple of things that were good. That was, you know, the F series was a very big thing. I won't take all the credit for it, but I certainly was involved in it, and that was very important. And in the rule that's still around, which is that foreign companies can use their own GAAP, and then in the notes they have to put footnotes about how it relates to the U.S. GAAP.
Mm.
Now that was part that I was very involved in that. But that at least meant that all these people didn't have to restate their accounting statements into American GAAP. They could use their own, but then they had to reconcile them in the footnotes, which at the time was seen as a big advance for a foreign company.
Mm-hmm.
Today they think it's not far enough.
Yeah.
But so I felt, and we also got some cash flow accounting rules in, I felt the F-series and particularly these accounting rules were something that actually happened because I was involved in them.
Mm-hmm. Did you work with corporate finance in some of these?
They were definitely.
Do you remember who was running?
Well, there was a woman named Linda. Linda, you must know her.
Right, I've got the name. Linda Quinn.
Right, Linda Quinn was one Linda Quinn I worked with a lot.
Okay.
And then there was Ed Green, who was also there.
Right.
And did a very good job. And there was a guy named Spencer. You'll remember his name.
Yeah.
Those are the ones I dealt with. But the big stars in my life at the SEC were my two legal assistants, Richard Starr and Steve Brown.
Other things that were going on at this point, and again, you've made clear that you were really focusing on some particular issues. But of course, you know, the whole idea of hostile tenders was getting awfully big at this point.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you recall the discussions and decisions being made at that point by the commission?
I don't really. If you tell me, it might remind me.
Well,
insider trading, I do remember that because I remember writing this article that said we should have triple damages for insider trading.
Right.
Triple damages. I was clearly involved in that issue. But I don't remember what the hostile takeovers were that were around, although I've always been interested in hostile takeovers.
Right. Well, it was interesting in that the SEC was really staying out of it at this point.
Yes, that's exactly right, because when I was chairman of the Corporation Law Committee, which was before I was on the SEC, I did the first big panel on the takeover of legislation, which was at a state level.
Right.
So I was interested in the points. Indeed, I got Joe Flom to talk, as I recall.
it almost seemed as if the commission had to work really hard to stay out of the issue at this point.
Like I said, as I told you, I don't know what John Chad's agenda was, but it wasn't. I don't remember anything coming up, because I was interested in hostile takeovers, because I'd done this big panel in New York, and I would have had a. It would have been a big issue for me if somebody was talking about it.
Right.
And so I don't remember that.
Right.
I remember that at the commission they were really involved in the secrecy thing, which I told you I was not involved in.
Secrecy.
With secrecy, this is a accord with the Swiss. You asked me about it.
Yes.
That was, they were interested. Shad and Fetters were interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
We were all interested in insider trading. That was a big thing.
Right.
But I don't, and I was interested in hostile takeovers personally, but I don't remember anything ever coming up there that, because I would have gotten very involved in it.
Yeah. How about the derivatives market?
You asked me. No, oh, I'll tell you what the other thing was interesting.
Yes.
It wasn't about derivatives, it was the CFTC.
Yes.
We were having this fight with the CFTC, which Shad was involved in.
Right.
Of who was going to who was going to regulate financial futures.
Right.
And that was very interesting because we all thought it was our jurisdiction and they thought it was their jurisdiction. And frankly, I knew they would win.
Why?
Because I knew Mary was smarter than Shad, but she was tougher and smarter.
Who was that?
Mary Shapiro.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure Mary Shapiro was the chairman then.
Okay.
You can check it. If it wasn't Mary, it was whoever. It was a woman.
Philip Johnson was in there.
Oh, maybe it was Philip Johnson.
Yeah.
Whoever it was, I knew in my mind, I thought,
yeah,
that person was smarter and tougher.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
was going to win.
Mary Shapiro came in a little later.
Okay, because I have a huge regard for her.
You're right.
But it was Philip Johnson. But I remember saying over and over again, we should be winning this. There's no question that we have the primary jurisdiction. But I don't believe that when you get Philip Johnson and Jeff Shad in the room, Philip Johnson will walk out the loser.
Yeah. Did you make that point in the commission?
No.
Hmm. Why not?
I didn't want to fight with Shad. And I didn't want to be insulting.
Right.
There wasn't any reason to be.
Right.
But I believe that Philip Johnson is a smart guy.
Yeah.
And I wasn't being denigrating to Jack Shad. I just have a huge regard for Johnson.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Just thought, as a corporate lawyer for my whole life, you have two people in the room. And there weren't a lot of other people in the issue, you know. He didn't bring thousands of troops with him, either one of them.
Right.
It was a pretty personal argument.
That's
how it was perceived to me.
Was it a surprise when Shad cut the deal with Johnson? When Shad cut the deal with Philip Johnson, then?
No, it wasn't a surprise.
Okay.
We were involved in it. I mean, we were being reported to.
Okay.
But as I say, so you want to know my other things that I was interested in?
Yes.
I was very interested when I first got to the commission in the cuts that the Reagan administration was making.
Oh, yeah.
And I wrote a lot of articles. One was called Cutting to the Bone. It's the first articles I wrote, I think, which criticized the Reagan administration on cutting the SEC's budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember writing articles that said, there's a lot of fat in the government and in the independent regulatory agencies, but not at the SEC. And this is a really important agency, and if you cut our staff, you will cut our effects. And I had a very high profile on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a lot of friends in that.
That made you a lot of friends?
It made me and the SEC friends, because I was on the right side. And not everything I did was people really cared about, but this one they did care about.
Did you find yourself on the other side of the fence from Shad on this one?
Well, Shad was, he wasn't about to offend the Reaganites.
Yeah.
He had just come in.
Right.
And he wasn't, and so he didn't like that. He didn't like it at all.
Yeah.
To be honest with you. But, I put my name on the article.
Did you see an effect of those budget cuts over the...
Yeah, well, they did cut it, but I thought they cut it much less. I thought I actually won that.
Yeah.
We had much less budget cuts. I was very vocal on it, and I had very many articles all around the country on the issue. because I didn't say we shouldn't cut the budget. I was very careful about that. Mm-hmm. I knew a lot of Republicans. I just said you shouldn't cut them here.
Right.
That this is a really important agency. If you do across-the-board cutting, what I said, you should just have sensitivity around where you're cutting.
Mm-hmm.
Across-the-board cutting was inappropriate.
Where did these articles turn up? Were you doing
newspapers?
Okay. Were you doing editorial-type things on that?
Yeah, editorial.
Okay.
One was in the Dallas Morning News, I thought. There was one was in the New York paper. They were, you know, I put them in a lot of different around the country places.
Uh-huh.
And they were always editorials.
Other issues that you were pushing for at this point?
No. Sounds like, as I'm talking, it sounds like I didn't do anything, but I remember being incredibly busy, so.
Uh-huh.
I was busy on issues that I cared about.
Right. Yeah, the only other issue that was on my list that we haven't talked about is the national market system and the idea.
Yeah, upstairs trading.
Yeah.
It was a new idea, upstairs trading, and it was just coming in. And I knew Gordon Macklin from the NASD, and I knew that some of the other guys forgot their names now. But it wasn't my issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was around the same time as shelf registration, because I was involved. I mean, I remember right after my son was born, I went to the SIA convention, Securities Industry Association,
uh-huh.
and gave a big speech on shelf registration and why we shouldn't have it.
Uh-huh.
Now, that was sort of, you're right, they were testing the shelf registration stuff for a year. And I was against it because my son was April 83, and I went and gave that speech, and that wasn't the first time I'd given the speech.
That must have been a tough speech, right?
It was.
Because that's not what they wanted to hear.
No, it's exactly what they wanted to hear.
That is what they wanted to
Absolutely.
Hear.
Absolutely. That's why they invited me.
Okay.
There was no question. I was getting invited all the time to speak against shelf registration by the medium-sized firm.
Okay.
They were very keen for me to come.
So there was a split between the smaller firms and the larger firms.
Absolutely. And the smaller firms were pretty big small firms.
Uh-huh. The ones with some clout, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to remember, Ellis Rothschild was a guy from Ellis Rothschild that was involved, and there was a guy from Drexel. Remember, Drexel wasn't a dirty word then. And there was a guy from... there was a guy from, it was all the big medium-sized firms.
Yeah.
Were against shelf registration.
Okay. Well, how about the decision to step down? Why did you come to that? You left a little bit early.
Yeah, because my husband was asked to go to Hong Kong.
Okay.
There were two things going on. I would have probably left anyway. I got pregnant, which I'd been trying to do for a long time.
Uh-huh.
That many years. And I was having a commuting marriage. My husband was in New York and I was in Washington.
Okay.
And it was getting very difficult with a baby and a nanny.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that I was going to have to go home early. And I was talking to Cuomo about being insurance commissioner of New York State at the time.
Mm.
And then my husband was asked by his law firm if he wanted to go to Hong Kong to start up a branch for Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said, well, that's good for him, but Barbara will never leave Washington because she's having such an interesting job. But remember, I was international.
Right.
And I knew that getting an opportunity for us both to go to anywhere abroad was going to be, might never come again.
Mm.
So even if I hadn't had the baby, I would have considered it seriously. But because I knew that this was getting a little difficult with a child and a nanny and, you know, running back and forth.
Right.
It was a great opportunity to be together as a family and to do something, was to put into practice what I believed, which was to be international. So I was absolutely thrilled with that idea. I was sorry to leave the commission, but I knew that if I'd stayed for the full term, I would have ended up going back to New York and practicing law in a firm like everybody else did. And I didn't want to do that.
Hmm.
I wanted to go live abroad.
So you went to the Montague Bank.
Samuel Montague. And actually what happened was my husband's firm didn't really want me to be a partner in my own old law firm because there were two, you know, one thing to be both partners in different firms
right.
in New York, big place, but little place like Hong Kong. But it didn't matter. I by that time, decided I was going to be a banker.
Hmm.
American lawyers at the time were very snobby about me. They thought they worked half as hard, were paid half as much, and were half as smart. So I had a little press release and said, I'm going to leave the SEC to follow my husband, and I'm going to be a banker. And and I got a lot of job offers. I wasn't sure. Somebody said to me, supposing nobody calls you. I said, well, you know, I'll take in laundry. I remember saying that. because I really wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
But remember all those articles. I knew a lot of international bankers.
Yeah.
And I got lots of job offers. But then I happened to meet this Swede who ran Samuel Montague. He said, Barbara, you don't want to go to an American bank. Hong Kong is a British place. You want to live in with the Brits inside the British establishment, not outside of it. So he was right. He convinced me. And he was right because I went to Hong Kong and I was a British banker. And no matter how American I look or act, in Hong Kong you are what your job is.
Well, just to back up just a little bit, you talked about the impression, the dominant impression of bankers, but why had you made this decision you wanted to go into banking?
Well, it wasn't that I wanted to go into banking. It's what I thought I could do.
Okay.
You see, if I couldn't be a lawyer, and I really didn't want to be a lawyer, so
okay.
It wasn't like I was fighting very hard.
Yeah.
And when I was a lawyer, I'd represented some banks.
Yeah.
And remember, we're talking about commercial banks. Although I have to say, I ended up being an investment banker. The fact is, lawyers and bankers do a lot of the same stuff. I did deals for my whole life. I watched what the investment bankers were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I could do that too.
Mm.
It all seemed like something I could do.
Okay.
And I had credibility with the bankers because I'd written all these articles. So, I mean, if I decided that I wanted to be an engineer, I would have had no credibility.
Right.
But I knew that I had lots of credibility as a banker. As an international banker, the markets were just opening. I had written a lot of what were then reasonably thoughtful pieces on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I did it.
How was the British banking establishment different than the American?
Very close in those days. And it was very male-dominated, and lots of people weren't thrilled to have this woman jettisoned in to be a director of a British bank. But the good story is that the Chinese weren't like that. In a Chinese family, the men make the money and the women run it. It wasn't such a big step to go from talking to the mother to talk to me. And we did quite well in Hong Kong. It was very interesting. And I loved it. And I did business with the Japanese because remember I'd met them earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you start making money for people, then they like it. So I had a really good time in Hong Kong. I was very happy, really happy. And actually, Geraldine Ferraro was running for vice president at the time. And a lot of the Chinese thought the next one would be me, which, of course, was ridiculous, but I was far away then. And I loved Hong Kong. That's why I live here now.
Right. You went to New York, right?
For a while, yeah, but I always missed Hong Kong.
Mm.
And I always was trying to get back there.
Did you do banking in New York as well?
Mm-hmm. I've been a banker in then for a long time.
Okay. Well, how did you end up? I mean, you talked about you ended up in the UK because of the Hong Kong experience.
Oh, well, what happened was that when I went back to New York, I didn't like it so much. I missed Hong Kong. I missed it. It was a very close society in Hong Kong. Very close, not closed, close. And you had very familial. And I thought, my story is, I didn't like New York. It was too rich. My friends were too rich. Everybody was too money-oriented. Remember, it was the bonfire of the vanities.
Right.
It was 1987. And I wanted to go back to Hong Kong. I never wanted to leave it in the first place, and I was unhappy to have left it. And I tried to go back to Hong Kong, but it's quite hard to get two jobs. You only need one for my husband and one for me.
Right.
And what happened was that I was offered a job in London. In Switzerland, to run a private bank in Switzerland. And my husband didn't want to go, he didn't speak French. And then he was offered a job in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And I didn't want to go. I didn't think there was a bank or a law firm in Pittsfield. What was I going to do, sell dresses?
Right.
So what happened was some man I met in the interviewing process for this Switzerland job came to see me in New York, and he said, can I take you out for a drink? I have a question. I need some advice. So I said, no, come home. I have a young child, and I go out too much. You can drink my white wine just as well as the Drake Hotel. So he came home, and he told me that he was looking for a lawyer for a new business, a big American kind of lawyer that had an Asian expertise. And in the door walked my husband, who frankly hardly ever came home before 7 o'clock in his entire life. And so I introduced him. And then I called the guy the next day and said, you should hire my husband. He's perfect. Great, big lawyer, Asian expert, very smart. And so they did. And that's how we got here.
Huh.
And I'm very happy here. I've lived here since 1993. Lots of interesting jobs. I'm chairman of the Atomic Energy Authority now.
Yeah, that one seems a little incongruous. Tell me how you got that particular job.
Sure. I came here as a director of News International, which is to do satellite television deals. And I stayed there for a couple of years, and then I went off to buy my own business, which was a drive. I'm a foodie, and I wanted always to have a food business. So I did that. I bought a food business as a venture capitalist. It's called Whitworth. It's like Sunkist, the raisins and dried fruits.
Mm-hmm.
It was lovely. I loved the business, but the venture capitalists sold it the way they do, you know.
Yeah.
And then I started a business with some other guys, which was called Private Equity Investor, and we raised £100 million, which is almost $200 million, to do a fund of funds listed on the London Stock Exchange. And essentially that got bought in a hostile takeover. And along the way, I decided that the best thing I'd ever done in my entire life worked for the government as an SEC commissioner. So I called a headhunter that I knew, and I said, you know, I'd love to get a job working for the government. And this guy, who's very nice, Barbara, the only thing we have going is a seat on the board of the Atomic Energy Authority. And I said, well, actually, that's not for me. I don't know anything about energy. And he said, well, it might be, because they want someone to run the audit for me, and you could do that, because, you know, I know a lot back. So I said, well, I'm like, but he put my name in. And lo and behold, it's on the short list. So I go in front of this panel, and they say, Mrs. Thomas, why do you want to have a seat on the Atomic Energy Authority? I said, well, I really don't, actually. But I'm looking for a job in the government, and this is what's around. But the one thing I can tell you is I'm a lawyer, and I'm very, very hard worker. And I will learn it. Just look at my academics. And I will learn it so well that when I find the job I really want in the government, I hope you'll be the referencer. And you know, they hired me. So I had a seat on the board. And once I got on the board, I did what they did. I promised them I learned it. My son, the one that just called me, sent me his chemistry books and his physics books. And I learned the subject, and I also got appointed just about the same time to another government job on the Energy Board, the Board of Energy. It was called the Energy Group Board of the Department of Trade and Industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that the Energy Board owned the Atomic Energy Authority. It didn't own it, really, but it reported to it in the governmental structure.
Right.
And they weren't talking to each other. Indeed, they were going in the opposite direction. And as I was on both of them, I tried to bring them together. And I did actually become the one that anybody trusted. And then they had set up another board, which was going to be around decommissioning, and somebody appointed me to that. So then I was sitting on all the boards that counted the energy field. And then the chairman of the Atomic Energy Authority was made a lord, and he had to resign. And the government said to him, who should be the next chairman? And he said, should be Barbara, perfectly clear. She's best, you know, I've been on the board for 2 years. So this time when I went up before the panel, and they said, why do you want to be chairman? I said, because I have learned it, and I'm the only one anybody trusts. And they made me chairman. And it's great. I'm thrilled. You know, I've just lucked out because energy is such a fascinating subject, and it's just now that it's really interesting. So I'm very happy.
Is this experience in any way analogous to sitting in the SEC?
No. But I'll tell you what is. Remember I said along the way, I said to those guys, when I find the job I really want, I hope you'll be the references.
Mm-hmm.
So along the way, they set up what's called the Financial Reporting Council, which is like the PCAOB in America.
Mm-hmm.
And the headhunter called me and said, they're looking for deputy chairman. Do you want to put your hand in the ring? and I sat on that board of that interview, because that's the way government jobs are done, by open interviews.
Mm-hmm.
They said, why do you want this job? I said, because I've been writing about international accounting standards for 20 years, 25, because I've been writing about international issues and corporate governance. And my SEC experience is very relevant and very important. And I got that job. And I do, that's more like the SEC. That's a collegial body that makes rules and thinks about corporate. I'm going tonight because tomorrow I'm talking about international securities regulation.
Yeah.
Last week I was in Chicago talking about the difference between American corporate governance and British corporate governance. Over the weekend I gave a speech at a conference at Ditchley Park on regulation. That's all stuff that started when I was thinking about it when I was at the SEC.
Right.
So that, and that's my second area. I do the energy first.
Hmm.
I'm chairman.
Mm-hmm.
I do corporate governance second if I'm deputy chairman.
Hmm.
And the experience is very relevant and very interesting.
So it turned out that the thing you decided to make your mark with at the SEC is still with you.
Absolutely. There's no question that I'm still interested in international accounting standards,
yeah,
and I'm still interested in internationalization of securities markets.
Well, terrific. At this point, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you'd like to bring up?
Well, I thought the commission experience was fantastic. As I said to you, I realized it when not so long ago. I thought to myself, now what am I going to do?
Uh-huh.
If I had to find out another job. That the SEC was the best experience. What was great about it was the people were all really smart. And they were all really confident that they were making a difference.
Mm.
And I felt like I was the luckiest person. I was very grateful for the opportunity. And it changed my life. If I hadn't gone to the SEC, I would probably still be a partner in a law firm.
Yeah.
Which would have been okay. But I had a really interesting life. And it's all because I changed careers and I went there and then I developed this interest in internationalization of the securities market,
mm-hmm,
which has stayed with me for my whole life. And it's always made me think that it's about people talking to each other. That little committee I formed was really, really good because I saw what I now know to be true, which is that if you had people talk to each other across the table, as opposed to across the ocean, we can get things done.
Hmm.
And that policy is about personality as much as anything else. Personal relations. I learned a ton when I was there about people.
Hmm.
And I felt that I was privileged to serve. Totally privileged.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me today. Thanks for the time.
Well, I hope I told you what you wanted.
Absolutely.
You've obviously done the work.